Hello, and welcome to our Inclusive Leadership podcast series. My name is Joanne Murphy, and I'm COO at the Chartered Banker Institute, and I'm delighted to be your host today. This is our third episode in collaboration with the team behind Men for Inclusion, Gary Ford and Mark Fried. In our series so far, we've discussed accidental sexism, which leads to being comfortable with the uncomfortable, and what inclusive leadership means, and some of the actions we can all take to be more inclusive colleagues. If you'd like to listen to our first two episodes, they are also available. In today's episode, we're now going to focus on how D&I can give an organisation a competitive advantage. Welcome, Gary and Mark. Good to see you again.
Hiya.
Hey, Joe.
Hi. So I thought to get us started, Gary, I've got a question for you, and I'm actually going to add in a new question we got from one of our listeners. So firstly, I'd like to ask, how can an inclusive manager develop their team to become a high-performing one? And on the back of that, one of our listeners asked, do personality traits affect inclusive leadership? So I'll start off with you, Gary, if that's okay.
Thanks, Jo. So let me start with one idea that I'm a very big fan of. This idea that high-performing teams are teams that regularly learn together. I think that's quite important. And one of the reference points for that is the work of a guy called Peter Senge, who wrote the most amazing book called The Fifth Discipline, which is about how organizations learn. And this idea that if you have a high performing team, it's good that they learn as a collective. So I think one of the things that I think an inclusive manager does is create an environment where A, learning is valued, and B, creating space for the team to learn is valued. And obviously with this sort of subject of inclusion, I think a lot of that learning is the ability to kind of find out more about, you know, the team in general, about their lived experiences, and about the, you know, the skills and capabilities that's created, and encouraging people to kind of find out more about their colleagues and, you know, what skills they are bringing to the table as a collective. So I think an inclusive manager really encourages that, you know, that knowledge across their team, and then looks at how, you know, the work we have to do as a team is managed in a way that A, gives everybody the opportunity to develop new skills, but B, also, you know, obviously allows us to leverage the expertise that, you know, the team have. So I think those two things are always in balance, but I think a good inclusive manager would try to make sure that you don't, you know, over focus on one, and therefore always give the same sort of set of tasks to the same people. So I think that's quite key. I mean, obviously every team has to do their, and we talked a little bit about this in one of the earlier sessions, their fair degree of, you know, admin or kind of non-value added work. That's always part of that. So I think one thing we do is make sure that that's equitably distributed. And this idea that we regularly review our performance as a team, I think is quite important. And we have some of those really honest conversations about, you know, where we've done things badly, but also where we've done things well, so that we, you know, and again, it's trying to create that environment where everyone can feel pretty open and honest about this, to sort of like call out things that they aren't feeling comfortable with. And also the fact that, you know, you're not feeling like, you know, you're carrying someone and one member of the team. Like, everyone has the opportunity to sort of like to have that kind of conversation. Feels that they're all getting opportunities, and they're also like also taking their fair share of the load as well.
Gary,
you're going to ask on that, yeah?
Yeah, I was going to ask just before I move on to that listener's question, actually, to build on this, but it was what caught my thought process there was when you talked about that collective learning environment and like almost playing to people's strengths and learning from each other and evaluating that as you go through that. Because I just recently looked at some MIT research, and it's about organizations and collective intelligence.
Yeah.
And actually, and basically what the research shows you is that if you categorize a team through IQ, for instance, gathering people together who all have a high IQ does not make a difference to overall, it doesn't make a statistical difference, real difference to the collective intelligence of the team. However, if you have a team who is quite diverse in terms of it has strong traits of more behavioral intelligence and linking into EQ rather than IQ, for instance, then if you have more people with those types of skills, more sort of people-oriented skills, then that actually improves the collective intelligence statistically of the team. And bizarrely enough, women tend to have more EQ traits statistically than others. So actually having more diversity in terms of women involved in teams actually can improve the collective intelligence of an organization in theory, according to their research. So it's interesting to think about. We're talking about these collective skills and the different skills that people bring to the table, but actually also, you know, it is about that collective intelligence and what improves that, which would ultimately give you a high performing team as well.
Yeah, you're spot on, Joe, and I think a lot of that is echoed in the Senge research as well. And this idea that individuals, there aren't many simple problems left to solve, right? So individuals trying to solve them is almost impossible. It kind of has to be solved by a team coming at it from many, many different angles. So I think that's a clear part of it.
And then, so just building on that, and I suppose linking into it as well, is that we did get a listener question about, you know, do personality traits have an impact on, do they affect inclusive leadership?
Yeah, and I think the short answer is absolutely. And I think, I guess there's two ways of looking at that. There's the personality trait of the leader, and then the personality traits of the people that kind of work for them. And I think from a leader, I think people have to realize that some of the things that we often think about as for an inclusive leader, great listening skills, empathy, this sense of, I don't know, wanting to understand the kind of lived experience of people around them, and therefore kind of being able to open up people in this. Some of those skills don't come easily to people, right? Some people really have to work at that. Whereas I think, like any other set of skills, some people it's more naturally something they're used to doing. And to your point about the difference between men and women, I think a lot of these skills, women are much more likely to be encouraged to develop when they're younger than I think perhaps some of the ways in which we encourage the type of skills that that boys typically have, where I think there is a view that they're much more likely to be encouraged to be, the strong boy, the person that kind of bottles up emotion and, is very independent and stuff like that. So I do think there are traits that we either naturally have or traits we develop that, sometimes means that for some people it will be a much harder, a little bit of a harder journey than for others. I think that's absolutely true. I often talk about myself. I kind of feel myself, I'm very introverted, and I don't think I've, emotional intelligence is a core strength. So I do have to practice and work at it. And then similarly, obviously, for the people in the team, then I think you have to always, adjust the way in which you operate as a leader to maybe get the best out of them as a team member. So I do think there's always an element of a leader having to adjust the ways in which they best interact with people, because I think people have a very different view of what an inclusive team looks like. And back to even the ideas about how you encourage people to share, some people are going to be more comfortable with that than others. Some people, you know, particularly if they're, you know, maybe have a more neurodiverse condition, some of those things will be very difficult for them and maybe not the right way to get the best out of that particular individual. So I do think you have to always be ready to adjust and factor in those concerns or those ideas into how you manage and lead any sort of team. And I think that makes, it's why I always feel leading a team is one of the most complex kind of things you can kind of do as a human being, actually. And often I feel that we don't give managers and leaders maybe enough preparation time to fully develop those skills. I think that's one of the challenges that we often see, people kind of thrust in these positions without necessarily having all the tools in how to best survive them, I suppose survive that role.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. And I think going back to that sort of collective issue, is, and we've talked about this in other parts of the series, is about treating people as individuals. And actually, to get the best out of a team, to get high performance, it is playing to people's strengths. It's not about creating clones of yourself as a leader or other people in the team. It's about playing to people's strengths, and actually the different traits and different strengths, that the greater the strengths that they have, and the greater variation gives you a stronger team ultimately. And that's where it really plays to that, isn't it? So, but as a leader, it's being able to cultivate those skills and bring out the real best in people.
There was someone that we did a bit of research recently about what, you know, what motivates men in particular to become, you know, champions of diversity and inclusion. And one of the comments we kind of felt was quite intriguing, where a man talked about the fact that he felt that he needed someone very different to him to really challenge him. And he said that was such a big positive for him. It wasn't just, you know, another yes man, if that's the phrase. It was someone he ended up hiring because he felt he needed someone who would challenge him, because his perspective was maybe so much, you know, historically, you know, based around a very particular upbringing that he had, a particularly very specific corporate life that he'd had up to that point. And he said, one of the things I relished was the fact that he was someone who was deliberately, not in a bad way, but deliberately, you know, ready to kind of just push a little bit against my way of thinking. And I saw that as a massive positive.
Yeah, and I think you hear that lots of times, don't you, from leaders? I heard Stephen Bartlett saying that recently as well, and he obviously is neurodiverse, but he recruits to cover off all the areas that he's not so good at. You know, that's what strengthens his overall organisation that he has. So thanks for that, Gary. Mark, see if I can come to you, because like we've talked in previous episodes about behaviours and cultures as well, but sometimes it's the actual organisational processes that don't help in all of this. And in a lot of sectors, hiring managers feel that they can't get candidates from underrepresented groups to apply. So I'd be interested in hearing from you about how do you think we can improve hiring approaches so that we can reach people who maybe feel that the advert's not speaking to them, or that they don't feel that they can be part of that organisation?
Joe, I think this is a question that I could have a whole podcast series on, to be honest. And it's something I'm quite passionate about. And I think, first of all, we have to recognise that sometimes when we're hiring, you know, the percentage of diverse candidates in our talent pool is almost by definition smaller than the majority candidates. And if we're talking gender, you know, in most cases, you know, the number of women in the talent pool are something like somewhere between 20 and maybe 50% of the candidates. So just put that to one side for a moment, and then let's just think about, before we start talking about processes, you know, recruitment is a, you know, is down to humans. It's not all down to machines. And I think it's really, really important to ensure that all of the humans in the process the hiring manager, the internal recruiters, the external recruiters, if you go to external recruiters, are all aligned and motivated to ensure that to find the best candidate for the job, for the team, for the firm, which is what we want, that actually they will go that extra mile to find candidates that fit the bill from a diverse background. And I see so often that doesn't happen. Yeah. And if there's one person in this link that is not motivated to go and do that or has no desire to go and do it, then the whole system breaks down. So let's make sure everybody in the recruitment processes are motivated to go and find those diverse candidates. The next thing is in understanding that there may be a smaller talent pool of diverse candidates than the majority candidates, it's understanding that actually, because there's fewer of them, they quite often take a little bit more time and cost a little bit more money to find. And what I see in so many recruitment processes, particularly if we're talking about that kind of bulk, middle, experienced, higher recruitment, is the first thing that happens is time to hire and cost of hire in the process takes over. So it's very easy once a recruiter gets a mandate to put something up on the firm's website and to put something up on LinkedIn. And quite often within hours, you've got a bunch of CVs coming towards you. Now, let's just say the talent pool is about, total potential talent pool is about 100 people, which would be right for some of the roles that we're recruiting for. And by definition, probably 80 of them will be men and 20 of them will be women. Out of those 80 men, statistics will say that roughly 8 of them will be actively looking for a new role. And they will apply for the position because they will see the ad, they will be searching for it, they will have their eyes open. Of the 20 women, it's highly likely that none of them are looking. Yeah. So waiting for people to apply and expecting to get a good range of diverse candidates is not the answer here. But then if those people aren't applying, it means that we need to give the recruitment process more time and more money to go and find them. Yeah, because it becomes a headhunting challenge rather than a recruitment challenge. Yeah. And we have to understand then is, do we know who those 20 women are? If we're talking gender, do we know how to reach them? Can we reach them? Can we have a conversation with them? And what is our proposition for them to leave their current firm and come and join this new firm? Why should they leave? And I think we have to understand as well, particularly when we're thinking about female candidates, is we need to think about, well, why should they move? If they're comfortable in their current role, it's quite risky to move where maybe you may be moving from a nice boss to potentially a misogynistic one. You might be moving from an environment where you've identified or created working practice and working environment that suits you down to the ground to one that doesn't. So we need to understand and create a proposition for people to come and join. So the underlying this is time to hire and cost of hire. And the Women in Finance Charter did some research into this and found that on average, it takes 130 days to recruit a woman and about between 70 and 80 days to recruit a man. Now, the vast majority of that time is done up front. because you need to go out and do these additional things to find great female candidates, if we're talking gender. So, and all that time is up front. Now, if the first thing we're doing is putting an advert on our website, we've got eight great men, and then we say, sorry, we can't find any women. And that's generally what happens. And what we've seen, we were working with an organization, a big investment bank, and one of the senior managers there had decided to do an audit of all the hires that had been made over the last year. And he had done something like 8 to 10 hires in his area, or his managers had. And what he found, he looked through this, and he found for each hire, for each potential, he had got a bunch and a group of different men applying for each role. But there were three women who the recruiter had put forward for every single role. That's time to hire and cost of hire. That's not motivating the recruiter to go out and go that extra mile. What had happened is he had found three women who had largely kind of maybe fitted the criteria, if you bent the criteria a little bit. And it was easy for the recruiter then to put those three women forward. So in summary, I think, you know, we need everybody aligned. And then we need to ensure that people have got the time and the cost, the budget, to go and really find those diverse candidates who, after all, if we want to increase diversity and inclusion within our business, are worthwhile going out and taking that bit of time and having that little bit of extra expense.
And I suppose it's also then about expanding your network. So not using the traditional tools, just advertising your website, just putting onto LinkedIn and hoping for the best. It is about going and sourcing those networks that women will be part of, that if that's your target audience or you want to get, you know, the right pool of talent available to you, or the best pool of talent available to you, then it is maybe fishing in different ponds because, well, rather than just doing what you always do, because if you do what you always do, then
Somebody said that once, yeah, didn't they? And I've forgotten who it was. Somebody, I'm sure somebody in our audience will tell us who that was. But yeah, if you keep doing the same old thing, you'll get the same old results. It's strange that. And I think by and large, what we've done, when I look at what firms are doing or say they're doing around diverse recruitment practices, it's tinkering. It's not addressing the big issue of we need more time and more budget. We need to fish in other ponds. We need to do things different, you know, extremely differently.
Yeah. And I suppose from an organization's perspective, if I could just play devil's advocate, because 130 days, realistically, most people, you know, even mid-management or more senior roles, 3 months notice period. You know, longer than that's rarer. That means there's no handover. You know, there's no handover, there's no time and job. So you can see why actually that that there would be certain candidates that do automatically appeal if they meet all the criteria for the role, because then at least you've got that sort of a bit of handover between the newcomer and the leaver. So I suppose it is just making sure that maybe we should be expecting, you know, recruiters who are paid well for these candidates and get good commission for going out and getting these candidates, that we actually have to ask them to work to a higher standard and sort of raise the bar for them and what an organization's expectations are as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I understand, as you say, from the hiring manager's perspective, I think, you know, so often, you know, a vacancy comes up because somebody has left. You know, John is leaving. I need another John, and I need another John as quickly as I can to fill that place. And if that is your driver, yeah, then you will probably end up with another John. And I think, you know, we do need to take a little bit more time and think about actually who we really want in the long term and what's good for the team, good for the business, and to think a little bit outside the box as well. As you say, do something different.
So it's good for recruiting for skills rather than experience as well, isn't it? That's where we start to think about the future skills in the future organization.
Yeah.
So building on that point, so Gary, if we do our best to get people in the door and get, you know, a diverse group of candidates, and we recruit for a diverse team that we want to be high performing, but how do we actually go about retaining high performing colleagues? And could you give any tips to our listeners in developing inclusive retention and development practices?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. And I think one of the challenges here is it comes back to a little bit what we were saying before about creating the right environment. And I think fundamentally, I think people want to feel when they join an organisation that as much as possible, they have a fair crack, they have a fair chance of being successful. So I think kind of establishing as much as you can, because I think it's impossible to be 100%, you know, meritocratic, but trying to create that strong sense of fairness and that clear view that everyone has the right opportunities. So I think that's the fundamental principle. I think as a manager, therefore, you need to then make sure that you're having regular conversations about, you know, what people want to get out of their career, recognizing that that can change fairly frequently. I think, you know, everyone, well, hopefully all managers, for example, will have a regular one-to-one catch up with all of their team members, but that has to be more than just the transactional, right? So maybe, you know, it's not just about the list of things that you need to get done on your work slate, but also a regular dialogue. So it's, you know, what are you looking for out of your career? In particular, look out for when people maybe need a bit more extra encouragement. Mark kind of mentioned it in the hiring kind of domain, but I think it's also true in the promotion domain that people from underrepresented groups, and I think it's often found to be true of women as well, they sometimes need that extra tap on the shoulder. You know, research has shown that organizations that their promotion process is just based around you have to stick your hand up for promotion will find that far more men will stick their hand up, whereas lots of women are kind of a little bit more reticent. They're almost waiting for someone to tap them on the shoulder and say, hey, I think you're ready for promotion, you know, and put you into the process. So I think you need to be aware of the fact that you need to be consistently encouraging people to try and develop and grow their career. And if I had a really good example once of a woman who worked for me, who she ran my testing team, and then one of my engineering team leads left, and I thought she was a perfect candidate to take on that role. And she was kind of like, well, I've never done engineering, I've only done testing. And I'm saying, I don't care. I think you've got all the right skills, and I think you'd be great at doing it. But it took me quite some time to persuade her that it was the right career move for her. So sometimes it's a question of, you know, providing the right encouragement if people, you know, if you genuinely believe that there's a growth opportunity for someone. I think the other thing that's quite important is also to make sure that that your environment promotes some level of flexibility. I don't think you want to kind of give anyone the impression that you give certain people special treatment, but I do think you have to allow for the fact that people need flexibility in their work, in their working life. And that's something that it doesn't need the corporate policy either. I think, you know, good inclusive managers make sure that they understand that people do need flexibility and they're able to be flexible, but also that's something that's available for the whole team as well. So I think you can see, we saw a little bit in some kind of company we were working with recently, where it was quite a difficult situation for flexibility. But I think it sounded like for the people that maybe didn't have a young family, the people that didn't have kind of other outside work needs, they felt that they were always the person being asked to do the weekend shift or the kind of late shift, stuff like that. So I think you've got to make sure that you're kind of listening to everyone, but I think, you know, offering flexibility for all is quite key. And then I think the final thing really is, I think you do have to deal and make sure it's seen to be dealt where performance or behaviors are not good. So I think people, the minute they feel that, you know, poor performance or poor behaviors are not being properly managed, I think that creates quite a negative impact on the environment of the team. So I do, and we talked a bit about it in one of the previous sessions, I do think an inclusive leader has to be able to take tough decisions and have tough conversations. So I do feel kind of dealing with when things aren't right and things aren't working well with a team, whether that's down to an individual or whether it's down to circumstances, I think you need to be able to cope with that well. And then the final thing I just want to point out is the fact that clearly from the long term, there are, when people take career breaks, and the most obvious one clearly is parental leave or maternity break, leave of absence, then I think you need to have specific tactics that enable people to be able to feel connected to the organization whilst they're away, but also have a path to which they can return to the organization, assuming they want to, in a way that hasn't disadvantaged them from their career perspective, but also allows them to be able to work in a way that now more suits their own personal circumstances, I think is quite key. So I think lots of good practices that I think organizations now thinking about, and you may have come across some of these, Joe, like keeping in touch days, you know, extra training when you return into work. Just the idea that you know, that they're connected to what the team are doing. You know, you don't take them out of, I don't know, promotion processes or bonus processes. I think, you know, you have to make sure that they are still managed in a really equitable fashion, and therefore, you know, taking a career break for whatever reason, because I think in the future there will be more of these, particularly as people maybe take career breaks because of aging parents, for example. We need to make sure that that's not an absolute career killer, and we have kind of practices that, you know, ensure that the impact of that is limited, assuming that's what people, you know, want to do with their careers. Clearly, they might want to concentrate on their home life rather than their career for a period. That's also perfectly fine too. So I think all of those things together are, you know, the, you know, ways we think you can begin to make sure that people feel that they've got a career that can be developed consistently.
I think that was a really good point you raised there about, you know, not even people like having a career break because of children, but also because their caring needs might change, because we have got, particularly in the UK, we've got an aging population. So that's something that we're going to see more commonly in the workplace. Mm. But what I'm hearing actually is back to this, treat people like individuals, know your colleagues well, play to their strength and treat them like an individual.
Absolutely. There was a really interesting phrase I heard the other day as well, because I think, you know, the way we envisage people's careers, people talk in terms of the career ladder, right? And sometimes if people, you know, have a career, you know, have a career break, it's kind of seen as stepping off the career ladder in some way. And someone kind of gave me an alternative version of the career ladder the other day I really liked. So they talked about the idea of a career cargo net. So it's just not a straight up and down thing like a ladder, but like it's a net, so you can move aside a little bit and then up. And I just really like that as a concept, right? Because, you know, how long's your career? It's, you know, a good 40 years, if not longer, right? There are plenty of kind of moving parts. And if you do take career break, particularly if it's to look after young children, but presumably also to look after aging parents might be another one, you're going to develop some really strong extra skills, I believe, right? That are going to help you, you know, add more to the team when you come back into the workplace.
So that's back again. That is back to that, you know, recruiting for skills. You know, it is that sort of focus on skills. And you make me laugh actually talking about, you know, career ladder, because I don't think I've had a career ladder at all, because I'm just about to stop being a school mum. And that doesn't mean that, and actually I've been a school mum for 22 years. I've been in the workplace for more than 30 years, but I've actually been a school mum for 22 years as well. So, you know, and it's that broadening, you know, every time I, took a period of mat leave, and I took for all of my children, I had a year off for each of them. You know, I either came back into a new job or an adapted job. My skills, I sometimes did a sideways move. So it wasn't always upwards. It was also broadening my knowledge at the same time. So I just think that sort of traditional way of thinking, life, real life's not really like that.
And Joanne, I think as well, sort of just adding to this, you know, Gary and I are a gentleman of a certain age. You know, you get to a point in your career, and I see it with a lot of you know, my friends and my peer group, where actually you want something different. You know, we're you know, in our late 50s, early 60s now, and you know, people don't want to. You're not going to keep climbing that ladder until the day you retire. We're working longer, and at that latter point of our careers, we all want something different as well, or most of us want something different. So I think, you know, even for, you know, the most sort of ambitious men, you know, you get to the point where you think, actually, I want to stop climbing. I want to go sideways. I want to do something different. And it affects us all. And organisations need to understand that.
And that's not, I think you're absolutely right. And that's not going to change. So Mark, just sort of building on that point, how should we go about rewarding and recognising inclusive working practices?
I think that's a good question. I think, you know, inclusive working practices and how do we go about rewarding them? I think, first of all, we need to differentiate between diversity and inclusion or culture. And, you know, the vast majority of us in the workplace have very little opportunity in the average week, quarter, year, or even in our whole working lives to really make a difference to diversity. We're not hiring every day. We're not promoting every day. But what we can do every second of every day is have an effect on culture. And somebody described this to me. It's like the inclusivity muscle or the culture muscle. And like muscles, unless we exercise them, they fall apart, they become useless, and bad practice comes in. Whereas if we practice, if we exercise, if we build strength, our inclusivity improves, culture improves, and everybody benefits. So I don't think this is just a how do we get a few people rewarded who are doing things off the side of the desk with culture and inclusivity. We need to think about, first of all, we need to think about everybody. But then there are obviously people within the organizations who might be described as culture carriers or inclusion leaders, people who are at the forefront because of their position, because of their personality, because of their thoughts or their networks or their seniority of moving culture in the right direction. And I think, you know, a lot of them may already have diversity targets, you know, that we've given them. We can also give those people inclusivity targets, and we can reward them for meeting those targets. And rewards sometimes, yeah, can be monetary, but it also can be recognition, you know, shout outs, awards, all sorts of things that we can make sure that those really important people who are, let's go, if we were talking about muscle, there are personal trainers, if you like, in the culture world, who are driving things forward. We need to make sure that they're recognized and rewarded, and it's not seen as a side of the desk job. That it is seen as core to business practice. So often I see people rewarded on what they do rather than how they do it. So, you know, they've reached their target this year, but there's like a, you know, World War II behind them that they've left with people that have fallen. You know, do we really want that? Or do we want people that have met their target whatever that is, if that's a monetary target, but also done it in a really great way that has delivered for not just for them, but for everyone around them, for the culture of the business. I think that's really important to think about. So,
And that's an ongoing thing, isn't it? Culture is an ongoing thing. It's not just I've reached my target and that's the end. It's you still continue to do it. We've had just sort of linking into this is we've had a question and from one of the listeners that sort of leans into this a bit because it says, why the disproportionate focus on gender diversity? Is boys versus girls just easier than other issues? And doesn't it risk confirming rather than challenging stereotypes and actually make finance look behind the curve?
I think this is something that Gary and I just kind of debate on almost on a daily basis. And I think we need to split diversity from inclusion. And clearly, you know, if we are trying to make the organization more diverse, we need to be thinking about gender. We need to be thinking about other forms of diversity, and we need to start measuring them and setting targets for them potentially. But when we're talking about inclusion, Gary and I typically, we start talking about gender. We may bring other forms of diversity into our discussion if it's appropriate. But at the end of the day, what is really important about inclusion, which by the way drives diversity, is that we look about everybody in our teams, everybody who we're managing, everybody who we come into contact with, and everybody who we like to come into contact with as individuals, not as diversity boxes. I think when we're talking about culture, it's about understanding and getting to know the individual, their strengths, their weaknesses, their ambitions, their desires, and managing and working with them in an appropriate way. We have to start somewhere on that road, which is quite often diversity. We have to start, if we're talking about inclusion, we have to show that people generally have different lived experiences. But the thing that we never want to do is reinforce stereotypes, because actually inclusion, from where I'm sitting, is about enabling people to take that stereotype, that straitjacket, to free ourselves from complying with those things. So it's a difficult balance, and I hope we get it right.
It's an interesting one, though, because I suppose the very fact is that the gender diversity, in a way, it's the biggest one to tackle in terms of just sheer 50% of the population as females. So if we can get that balance, if we can get a better balance in our talent pool, then naturally we should hopefully also bring in the intersectionality that also exists within that female population and male population when it comes to more inclusive workplaces at the same time. So yeah, it can be a sort of catch-all, but the very fact that we're tackling the biggest element of it does allow us to hopefully tackle other elements along the way at the same time. It should never be an either or. It's not just like, oh, we've done the diversity bit, end of, we can move on to something else. It needs to be a whole holistic approach to it.
And I'm just picking up on a point that you said there, we've done the diversity bit, so let's move on. And I think we're hearing a lot of that, maybe not in those exact words. There's diversity fatigue. This isn't a burning issue anymore because we've improved a little bit. We haven't got as far on our journey as making sure that our workplaces have got the right cultures and the right inclusivity, and if we don't focus on those, we'll slip. It's a slippery slope backwards.
I believe we're still 200 years away from equity. Yeah, still got some way to go there, definitely. Gary, can I just bring you in for a minute there? Just like moving back, because we've been talking about like the importance of actual organisations and where it gives you a sort of competitive advantage. So, you know, if D&I is going to give organisations a competitive advantage, what does DE&I transformational change program, what does that actually look like in an organization?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I think the first and foremost to say is it probably needs to kind of look, feel, smell like, you know, any other transformational change program would do, right? Yeah. And I think, you know, you often feel like a lot of DEI strategies, a lot of DEI programs are kind of, you know, a bunch of very passionate, you know, but very, you know, time poor people trying to kind of, you know, change culture from the sides of their desk. So I think if you are considering this as a strategic change program, then it needs to look like that. And what do those things typically have? They typically have, you know, a level of investment, they have resources allocated. They have executive sponsorship, they kind of have a degree of governance, and there's proper planning involved, and there's, you know, there's a business case with some measurements about how you're going to measure success, and you're going to have a sort of change management strategy that goes alongside that, and a communications plan. And actually, it, you know, when it comes to the resources, there'll be staff with people who are skilled at transforming organizations. And one of the challenges with, you know, the way people set up their DI programs kind of aligned often around the kind of concept of an employee resource group. And I do think employee resource groups are important things and things that organizations need to have. But in a way, you're almost expecting those groups to try and change culture. And that seems a little bit unfair to me somehow, right? It's just like, just because this person happens to be a woman, or just because a person happens to be from, you know, happens to be gay, that makes them cultural transformation specialists, which some of them may be, but probably quite a lot of them aren't, right? So are you giving the program the right set of people with the right set of skills to actually, you know, do all those things? And there is a room for those individuals, but if that's all you have, I'd argue it's just maybe not quite enough. So I think it needs to feel like that, you know, that core business imperative. And I think we all know what they look like, and it needs to look like that. And it's interesting that we were having a conversation with an exec team at a large UK firm last week, in fact. And one of the things, we talked about this concept with them, and one of the execs said, look, we're really supportive of doing this. We think we're doing some great work, but it feels like right now we don't have, and I think the phrase was, a burning platform, okay? Which is interesting, right? So to be fair, I think it's an organization that Mark and I feel are quite inclusive. But this idea is that, you know, do we need to invest strategically because we don't have a burning platform? And the thing that sort of struck me is that it's a bit like your technology. If you're not continuously investing in it, it begins to degrade, right? And when technology degrades, well, one of the things that happens is it opens you up to far more likelihood of cybersecurity related issues, right? Because the vulnerabilities become more and more prevalent the older you're. And it began to occur to us that if you're not continuously investing in the culture of the organization, then again, you do risk the fact that it could begin to atrophy. To Mark's point earlier, you begin to lose some of that inclusion muscle in a way. So I do think it's one of those things that you should think about as a continued investment. Now, that doesn't mean to say that you have to spend tons of money on it every year. I think like any other strategic program, there probably are peaks and troughs of how much investment you're willing to put in on any given year. But even if it's a year where you're going to scale back investment, I still feel it needs to look like a strategic change program, right? So it has to have, you know, all of those kind of accompanying parts. You know, you can vary the level of investment each and every year. I'm kind of cool with that as an idea, but to simply just treat it as a continued side of the desk activity, I just do think it risks, you know, some of that cultural kind of improvement just atrophying. You know, and clearly the end result of that is something quite extreme, like happened to the, you know, the Confederation of British Industry or the Crispin O'Days of the world, where clearly there wasn't that continuous focus perhaps on, are we building the right culture?
Yeah, and that's sort of quite short term, isn't it? It's very short term, isn't it? It's not going to drive sustainable organisations in a world of social media. You know, yeah. I think we'll see companies failing at a quicker rate, actually, that don't make the investment and don't meet people's expectations around it. I think it's very short term.
You're spot on, Joe. And actually, you think about it, kind of, I think it, I mean, this whole conversation zone, we talked earlier about how, how teams learn together and how they kind of develop skills. I think there's a whole resiliency angle to this. And I also think there's a sustainability angle to this as well, right? This is about how you sustain the way in which the organization continuously does the right things in the right way. I think these things are very closely related.
So just building on that point, Mark, I'm going to bring you in for a final question because I'm conscious of our time and our listeners. We could talk so long about all of these topics, but if you are making a strategic investment in DE&I, how do we measure success?
I think clearly, in a whole host of ways, there's not one great measure. There's not one ultimate measure that we can put down. Clearly, sort of, you know, business success comes very high on that. But then measuring non-financial risk. Yep, the regulator, the shareholders, our customers and what they think, whether we're delivering great product, are all good business cases for doing this. But then also, I think, you know, at a more granular level, measuring diversity in as many forms as we want is important, but also measuring inclusivity and measuring the lived experience of our teams and our staff is really important as well, to make sure that cultural muscle that we talked about, that inclusion muscle, is being exercised, and we are improving on a annual basis. I think these are all good forms of that we should be thinking about. Are we complying? Are we market leading here?
I think I really love you brought in that sort of the lived experience, because that's the real telltale of culture, and hopefully we're going to be doing something more than that together in the future too, which would be great. So. Yeah. Sadly, we have come to the end of our Inclusive Leadership podcast series. Hopefully it's given our listeners some really great insight into the subject matter, as well as plenty of ideas of what you can take back to your business and what you need to do to become a real inclusion leader and a real colleague who champions inclusion. First of all, I'd like to just say a massive thanks to all of you who have listened to the series, and especially those of you who took the time to send in questions to be answered. And secondly, I'd like to thank Mark Fried and Gary Ford from Men From Inclusion for sharing their knowledge and expertise in the subject matter. Thank you so much. It's been a great joy to speak with you both, and I've really enjoyed the conversations. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe, and great job chairing it. Amazing too.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.